Smell that? Close your eyes for a second and stand with me here on the grass at Whitman Field. It's early, the dew's still burning off, and if you walk the vintage rows before the crowds thick up, you catch it. Butyrate dope, warm engine oil, cut grass and 100 low lead. That smell hasn't changed in 90 years, and neither has the airplane I want to talk about today. This is Radio Hangar, I'm Taildragger, and you're listening to The Hangar. It's AirVenture Week in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, half a million of us, pilgrimaging to the same patch of Wisconsin sod we always do. And today I want to pull up a chair right next to one of the most restored, most beloved, most stubbornly alive airplanes on this whole field. The Boeing Stearman. The Yellow Peril. The airplane that taught America to fight. Now before I get rolling, let me tell you who's keeping the lights on today. This show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And if there was ever an airplane that understood that a milestone is worth marking, it's the one so many of us solo dreaming about. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, pull up a chair. Let me take you back. Back to the middle 1930s, Wichita, Kansas. There's a company called Stearman Aircraft, and by then it's already folded into Boeing, though the name stuck the way good names do, and they build a biplane. A big, honest, upright biplane. Two open cockpits, one behind the other. A fabric-covered fuselage over a welded steel tube frame. Wooden wing spars, wooden ribs, the whole thing skinned in cotton and painted with dope until it's tight as a drum. They called it the Model 75. The Army called it the PT-13 and the PT-17. The Navy called it the N-2S. And the kids who flew it, thousands and thousands of them, they called it the Yellow Peril because the trainers wore Navy training yellow and because a green cadet in one could be, well, a peril to himself and everyone around him. Here's the thing about this airplane. It was never meant to be gentle. Now here's where it gets interesting. The Army and the Navy didn't want an easy trainer. They wanted an honest one. They wanted an airplane that would talk back, get sloppy on the rudder and a steerman, and it'll swap ends on you in a heartbeat during landing. That narrow gear and that big rudder, it demands feet, real feet, the kind of stick and rudder we don't always teach anymore. And that was the whole point. The idea was simple and a little brutal. If you could tame the Yellow Peril, you could probably be trusted with a fighter. If you ground looped it into the weeds on your third landing, well, better to find that out now, over a grass field in Kansas, than later over the Pacific in something with guns and a whole lot more horsepower. So they built them. They built them by the thousands. More than 10,000 of these airplanes rolled out of Wichita before the war was over. And nearly every American aviator of that generation, Army or Navy, put their hands on a Stearman before they put their hands on anything else. Picture that cockpit. It's open to the sky. You've got a leather helmet, goggles, a rubber GoSport tube so your instructor can holler at you from the back. There's no electrical system to speak of on a lot of them, no starter. Somebody swings the prop by hand. That big radial up front, a Continental or a Lycoming, depending on the model, catches with a cough and a puff of blue smoke and settles into that lopy round engine idle that makes every one of us go a little weak in the knees. The wind is in your face. The whole world smells like exhaust and leather. You're cold in the winter and cooked in the summer, and you can hear everything, feel everything, the airplane speaking to you through the stick and the seat of your pants. That's how a whole generation learned to fly. And then the war ended. Here's the part that always gets me. When the fighting stopped, the military had these thousands of trainers and no use for them, so they sold them off. Surplus. Dirt cheap. A man could buy a running Stearman for a couple $100s, sometimes less, sometimes with a spare engine thrown in the crate. Now what do you do with a big, rugged, docile-hauling biplane that can operate off any rough field and lift a real load? You dust crops. That's what saved the Stearman. All across the farm country, from the Mississippi Delta to the California valleys, these airplanes went to work. They tore out the front cockpit, put a hopper in there, hung spray booms off the lower wings, and sent them out at dawn to fly 10 feet off the corn. Hot, dangerous, low-level work. They wore those airplanes hard. Bent them, patched them, flew them until the fabric rotted and the wood checked and the engines wore out. But here's the beautiful irony. All that hard use in the ag fields is exactly why so many survive today. While the fighters and the bombers got melted down for scrap aluminum, the humble Stearman just kept working. It stayed employed. It stayed flying. And when the ag operators finally moved on to purpose-built spray planes in the 60s and 70s, there were still hundreds of tired old Stearmans sitting in barns and behind hangars all over America. Waiting. Waiting for somebody like the folks you'll meet right here, on these vintage rows. Let me tell you what it actually takes to bring one of these back. because this is a restoration spotlight, and the airplane is only half the story. The other half is the people, and the craft, and the thousands of quiet hours nobody sees. Start with the frame, that fuselage's welded steel tube, and after 70, 80 years, and maybe a career of hauling insecticide, you've got rust, so a good restorer strips it bare, sandblasts it, and goes over every single joint looking for corrosion, looking for cracks in the old welds. Sometimes whole sections of tube get cut out and replaced. It's slow, it's unglamorous, and it's where a restoration lives or dies. Then the wood. Those wings are built up out of wooden spars and ribs, and wood doesn't forgive water. So you're inspecting every rib, checking the spars for cracks and rot, re-gluing, sometimes building brand new ribs from scratch off the original drawings. There are people, and you'll find some of them walking this field today, who can build a steerman wing rib by hand and make it look like it came out of the Wichita factory in 1942. And then comes the fabric. This is the magic part. You take that bare wing, that bare fuselage, and you cover it. Modern restorers mostly use a polyester fabric system now, but the old souls still do it the original way with cotton or linen. Either way, you stretch it, you stitch it, you rib stitch every rib so the covering can't lift in flight. And then you paint it, coat after coat of dope, and between coats you sand, and you coat again, and you sand again. You do that until the surface is glass, until you can see the hangar lights reflected in a wing that's made of cloth and lacquer and patience, and that navy yellow. When it's finally done, when that fresh yellow catches the morning sun out here on the grass, it stops people in their tracks. It stops me in my tracks, and I've been walking these rows for more years than I care to admit. Now this airplane and this event, they grew up together. The Experimental Aircraft Association, the EAA, the folks who put on this whole show, they were built by people who wanted to build and restore and fly airplanes with their own two hands. And the Stearman is just about the perfect expression of that spirit. It's simple enough that a dedicated amateur working nights and weekends in a two-car garage for the better part of a decade can actually finish one. And it's beautiful enough and historic enough that when they roll it out here, it means something. Every year they come. Down in the vintage area and over in Warbirds, you'll find rows of them, wingtip to wingtip, that training yellow lined up like a summer cornfield. Some are showpieces judged down to the last cotter pin for the awards this community takes so seriously. Some are working airplanes flown in from a grass strip three states over, bugs still on the leading edge. And some are giving rides, taking a brand new passenger up into that open cockpit to feel the wind and hear that round engine for the very first time. There's even a whole separate fly-in built just around this type, out in Galesburg, Illinois, every Labor Day where these airplanes gather by the dozens. But it's here at Oshkosh during this one week in July that the whole world gets to see them. And here's what I want you to understand. Standing here in the smell of dope and grass, when you look at one of these airplanes, you're not just looking at an antique, you're looking at a chain. That airplane trained a young man who went off to fly a Corsair or a Mustang or a B-17. That same airplane came home and fed a farm family dusting cotton. Then it sat, forgotten, until somebody with grease under their nails and a fire in their chest decided it was worth saving. And they gave it years, years of their one life, spent rebuilding somebody else's airplane so that you and I could stand here on this grass and remember. That's not restoration, that's resurrection. And every one of these yellow biplanes on this field is somebody's love letter to the people who flew before us. The engines are starting to fire up down the line now, I can hear it. That's my cue. My thanks for today's history goes to the folks at the EAA and the Vintage and Warbird volunteers who keep these stories alive, to Boeing's own account of the old Wichita Works, and most of all to the restorers themselves, the ones who will tell you every rivet and rib if you just ask. You can find more of what we do over at RadioHangar.com. So next time you're walking a flight line and you catch that smell, warm dope and old oil and cut grass, stop for a second. Say hello to the yellow peril. She earned it. I'm Taildragger. Keep your feet moving on the rudder, and I'll see you out on the grass.